How did these mechanisms help inform you of its potential to be a good ant? Why? I don't know why I can't get these.
Okay. Too much coffee. He had too much coffee
today.
I've
had a lot of coffee today. Okay.
Welcome to Translation. I'm your host, Seth Bannon, a founding partner at 50 Years, a venture capital firm backing founders using technology to solve the world's biggest problems. Translation is the process of turning basic scientific research into therapies that cure disease, new sources of energy that heal the planet, and other things that move the world forward. This podcast takes a deep dive into scientific achievements with huge potential to improve society. We talk directly with the people advancing the science with their own hands and minds, and focus on how we can translate the science from the bench to the benefit of all. Welcome to Translation.
Behind every success, there are people with the courage to try.
To create new sources of energy, to fix the carbon in our atmosphere, to cure disease.
Hey everyone, it's Michael Chavez, co-host of Translation, fellow at 50 Years, and graduate student at Stanford University. Today, we are talking to Dr. James Martin about his paper, A Dual Mechanism Antibiotic Kills Gram-Negative Bacteria and Avoids Drug Resistance, published in Cell in May of 2020. Bacteria are rapidly evolving to resist the killing effects of antibiotics, posing one of the greatest challenges to human health in the coming years. This is not only a scientific problem, but also an economic one, as pharma has been disincentivized to create new antibiotics that can treat this oncoming infectious wave. James, along with his colleagues Joseph Sheehan and Benjamin Bratton, use state-of-the-art biotechnology, including CRISPR, proteomics, and machine learning, to find a new antibiotic that is extremely effective and hard to evolve resistance to. James, Joseph, and Benjamin performed this work in Professor Zemer Gitai's lab at Princeton University.
James, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
So before we go into the paper, I would love to hear a little bit about you, but I want to address the most important thing first. Beyonce. As I understand it, you met Queen Bee because she heard about your research and wanted to meet you. So can you tell us what happened there, and do you still keep in touch?
Good question. So at the time that I met Beyonce, I hadn't yet done any big research, but she did hear that I graduated college a little early. And so she hit up my university at that time, Florida Atlantic University, and then wanted to congratulate me in person. And so she brought me and my family up to Philadelphia for her Made in America tour. And I got to meet her and hang out with her backstage for a little bit before getting to watch her show.
Wow, super cool. And how early did you graduate?
I graduated university the summer before I turned 18.
Very cool. So it would be great to hear a little bit more about your story. What got you interested in biology initially? And then how did that evolve into a love of microbiology and how that relates to human health?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I was homeschooled, and one of the things about being homeschooled is that my mom made traditional chores learning activities. And so what that meant is give your mind a break meant go help weed out the garden. So, you know, after school, I'd be outside messing with the weeds, trying to grow these different plants. You know, I'm Jamaican from birth, and one of the things we love to do is grow our own food. And that includes things like lemongrass and potatoes and basil. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I loved was understanding how the plants actually grew. And that bolstered my love for plant biology, actually. That was the first publication I ever had, was in plant biotechnology. And my love for microbiology really didn't come until grad school. And in Princeton, what they make you do is basically explore a new field for your first rotation. You know, your first go at a lab, you have to try something you've never tried before. And for me, that was with Zemer, looking at bacteria. And I didn't fall in love at first, but over time, I really began to appreciate the complexities of these single-celled organisms. And as I began to learn, I began to appreciate also how important antibiotics are to our human health, and also the microbiome, how these little guys who are more numerous than even the cells in our own body affect our health. They're incredibly important.
Do you still grow herbs, by the way?
I do. I have a small herb garden. I grow basil and rosemary right now. And we grew garlic, me and my wife. And You know, garlic actually is really hard to grow and it takes a long time. But we only got the garlic greens and we ate those up. So it was good.
You need an advanced technique for garlic.
Yeah.
So in a few sentences, can you describe your paper to a general audience?
Yeah. With the rise in bacteria that are resistant to the antibiotics that we use today in the clinic, we needed to find a novel way to identify unique antibiotics that bacteria had never seen before, and as a result would have a hard time getting resistance to. And so with the help of my co-authors, Joseph Sheehan and Ben Bratton, and my PIs, Amir Gitai, we used a multiple different methods to develop a novel pipeline to identify this molecule, SCH-79797, which is a novel antibiotic that is able to destroy bacteria, kind of like a poison arrow is what we call it. So it's able to pierce through the outer membranes and the inner membranes of the bacteria cell wall, and then it's also able to attack intracellularly and disrupt their metabolism, their ability to grow and reproduce.
Antibiotics, obviously, are drugs that kill bacteria and, you know, are quite possibly the most important class of therapeutic molecules that we have.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit about why antibiotics are so important and how they've changed the entire medical field?
You know, antibiotics, we think of them as pretty novel, right? We've only really started looking at them for the past 100 years, you know, since the 1920s when Alexander Fleming developed and produced penicillin. However, there's studies that show that ancient cultures were using antibiotics way before that. Ancient Egyptian cultures actually used to make a poultice out of mud from the Nile seabed. You know, and we know that most of the antibiotics we have currently come from soil-dwelling bacteria. There was another study that showed that in the medieval times, people used to take a poultice of moldy bread and put that in their wounds as well. And we know that penicillin comes from mold. And so what I get from this is that antibiotics aren't a new phenomenon necessarily, but the large-scale production of them is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the thing that's been interesting over the past 100 years, watching how we, as you know, the developing world, are trying to capitalize on this new ability to make a large amount of this medicine.
Interesting. And our ability to produce these antibiotics at large scale has meant that getting a splinter is no longer a life-threatening problem. And it's enabled a bunch of surgeries that used to be life-threatening to just be fairly routine.
Yep.
They've just had a tremendous impact on our entire society.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the interesting things about bacteria, like, say, MRSA, is that they have a very quick doubling time, you know, about every 30 minutes. And so what that means is that every 30 minutes, they're able to update their genome and function to evolve resistance to antibiotics. And so this phenomenon, evolved antibiotic resistance, is an extremely pressing human health risk. And so going a little deeper here, what are some of the ways that antibiotics kill their target? And then can you tell us about how bacteria can evolve to overcome those mechanisms?
If you think about a bacterial cell, there's, you know, two or three basic components that it needs to live. One, it needs protection. And so it has a cell membrane and a cell wall.
Mm-hmm.
Two, it needs to grow and divide. And so it makes proteins, it multiplies its DNA when it splits. And for some bacteria, they need to move, right? They swim into new areas in order to be effective. And I think those major three categories is how a lot of different antibiotics work. So they either poke holes in the membrane or prevent bacteria from developing a new cell wall when they're dividing,
mm-hmm.
or they inhibit the ability to make new protein or RNA or DNA in that case. And sometimes you don't even have to kill the bacteria in order to prevent an infection, right? You can just prevent them from making toxic things to your body, right? We call that the ability of bacteria to do that, we call it virulence.
Mm-hmm.
And you can target that. And so these bacteria then become innocuous, right? And how do bacteria basically become resistant to that? Well, one way is if you're shooting something deadly in, the bacteria will just kick it out.
Mm-hmm.
They have these protein efflux pumps that can take things that they deem dangerous and pump it back out of the cell. Or they can mutate their protein or in some cases their even DNA to reflect whatever you're treating them with so that that thing is no longer effective. Right. For example, if you're having an antibiotic that binds to the ribosome, right, the thing that makes proteins in the cell, they can mutate their ribosome so that your drug no longer has anywhere to bind effectively. And so they can continue growing and dividing and being happy. And lastly, one of the mechanisms that I think is also very important is they can outpace the drug that you give them, right? The drug that you have sometimes can only kill a certain fraction of the population. You know, at a certain dose, let's say you kill 80% of the population. That's fine in most cases. But if those bacteria are able to ramp up that doubling rate you were talking about, let's say increase it from 30 minutes to, let's say, 20 or even 15, they can dilute out the drug that's present and resist, quote unquote.
It's absolutely incredible to me how clever these incredibly simple microbes can be in trying to overcome the antibiotics that we throw at them. So I'm wondering, why are we now seeing antibiotic resistance as such an issue? Like, what happened that got us to this point where it's such a problem in our society?
I think we got greedy. That's what I will say. If you look at 2010, 2012 data, about 40% of the antibiotics we used in this country were used in agriculture, not even related to human health. And what that does is it gives the bacteria in our environment extra time to develop resistance to these super important life-saving molecules. This soil-dwelling bacteria has now gotten a chance to see low concentrations of this antibiotic that you normally use in a clinic. And that wouldn't be a problem if that bacteria isn't going to continue to spread. And next thing you know, that bacteria ends up in your hospital, and now you have a hospital-acquired infection that is resistant to the very thing that you went to the hospital to get to save you. And it's only gotten bigger. You know, everyone quotes the data from the UK that says by 2050, more people could die from antibiotic-resistant infections than from cancer. And so it really is a major problem that we need to address.
And so just to dig in there, these bugs, they need to be exposed to the antibiotics to learn how to become resistant. And normally they would only be exposed if a person was sick and you'd hit them with it. And that wasn't enough time. But because of these factory farms with all these animals that are constantly being pumped full of antibiotics, these bugs are getting exposed to our tools more often and earlier and are therefore able to evolve resistance. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, that's one way. But the other way is to remember that most antibiotics that we have are, or at least are, derived from naturally occurring molecules. So if you think about it, bacteria have different people to fight than humans. Bacteria have to compete with each other. Bacteria have to compete with fungus. And all of this is a competition for nutrients. And so the same bacteria that produces an antibiotic also has a gene to prevent it and its neighbors from dying. And so if that gene, basically through horizontal transfer, gets into a population of bacteria that didn't have it before, that resistance will also spread. And if a dangerous bacteria, a pathogen, gets that plasmid or that piece of DNA that encodes resistance, that can be very dangerous.
The old fungi-bacteria rivalry. We could do a whole podcast just on that.
You could. And it'd be really cool if you bring plants in there, because plants actually will house one or the other depending on which one they want to win.
So complicating this issue even more, bacteria can come in two flavors, gram-positive and gram-negative.
Correct.
Which each have their own natural susceptibility to different antibiotics. Can you tell us about the difference between those two types and how those differences impact which antibiotics work on each type?
In simple terms, gram-negative bacteria have a double membrane. They have an inner membrane and they have an outer membrane. And gram-positive bacteria only have one. And what this ends up doing is it gives gram-negative bacteria, you can almost think of it as an extra defensive barrier. And so a lot of the antibiotics that are able to target gram-positive bacteria have a very difficult time targeting gram-negative, sometimes becoming ineffective. And that's something that makes our molecule SCH really cool, is because it was able to kill both gram-negative and gram-positive.
So you started this project with the goal of developing a drug that could kill both gram-positive and gram-negative, that prevented resistance, and that was readily accessible. And so, like many drug discovery pipelines, you screened a huge number of small molecule compounds to see if they had a bacterial killing effect. How did you perform that screen?
One of the authors on the paper, Max Wilson, what he was able to do is he utilized our chemical library in the chemistry department at Princeton, and he took a relatively average concentration of each antibiotic that we wanted to study, and he grew bacteria in it, and these bacteria were very special. They were gram-negative bacteria in terms of their genome, their E. coli. However, these bacteria had a mutation, a deletion specifically, in one of their membrane proteins mm-hmm. that made their membrane permeable so that they had the same susceptibility as a gram positive while still having the genetic makeup of a gram negative. You know, so we can have our cake and eat it too. And doing that, we were able to identify several compounds that were able to effectively kill this bacteria.
This molecule, SCH-79797, is what popped out of the screen, and its original effects were characterized on human cells. How did these mechanisms help inform you of its potential to be a good antibiotic candidate?
So it might surprise you, but they really didn't. They really gave us no help at all.
Fair enough.
So the protein that SCH targets, which I'll only be calling SCH because all those numbers at the end get very confusing, but these, you know, SCH targets this protein in humans. It's actually not present in bacteria at all, which was kind of weird to us because we had no lead. And as I dive deeper into the literature, the only paper that I saw was a paper that said SCH can kill mammalian cells sometimes, but we don't know how. All we know is that it's unrelated to its natural function as a thrombin R inhibitor. So we were kind of confused, not going to lie.
So you now know that this drug works on E. coli, and you have a clue that it could be used as a broad antibiotic from previous work. Mm-hmm. What do you do now to demonstrate that this can work against other bacteria to see whether it meets the goals you set for yourselves?
So what we did, we picked a couple different bacteria that we knew were really important in the clinic. So one of those was a gram-positive bacteria, MRSA, which you've already brought up. And for a gram-negative, we looked at Neisseria gonorrhea and Acinetobacter baumannii. Both of these are incredibly important pathogens. Neisseria gonorrhea, we only actually have one last resort antibiotic left. Neisseria has become resistant to all the other ones. And in terms of Acinetobacter, it's actually a very hardy bacteria. It's able to resist desiccation, drying out by heat, and it will persist on almost any surface. And so we looked at both of these gram negatives and a few other gram positives, and we were able to see that our drug at relatively low concentrations was able to kill. And I say kill because we actually can see that these bacterial cells are dying. They're exploding if we look under the microscope. And that's powerful, right? There are no real antibiotics that can do that at this moment with the undetectably low levels of resistance that we have.
And how did you measure those resistance in these assays?
Yeah, since the purpose of your podcast is to get a little behind the scenes, we did it two ways. So the original way is to take a plate of media and you add your drug to it, and then you just plate a shit ton of bacteria on top. So 10 to the ninth, so like 10 to 100 million cells. And then you sit and you wait for a few days and you hope that one of those cells has a mutation that makes it resistant. So we did that with SCH and nothing came up. And so I read a paper and came up with this idea of doing serial passaging in the 96-well plate. The idea being you treat your bacteria with a sublethal dose of your drug and you repeat this dose day after day after day. Kind of the same idea as I was describing with bacteria in nature. And the idea is that when the bacteria see these low doses of the drug, bacteria that have a mutation that give them a slight fitness effect will take over the population, and slowly but surely, most of your population will have greater fitness that will allow them to survive SCH treatment. However, again, we didn't get anything. The bacteria kept dying at the same concentration over the course of a month, while other antibiotics such as the DNA synthesis inhibitor, novobiacin, or a folate inhibitor, trimethoprim, gave resistance in a matter of days. And so this was concerning on one hand, because we didn't have a mechanism yet. And finding resistance is often the key to finding your mechanism.
Right.
But it was also exciting because this is the dream. This is exactly what we want, a antibiotic that bacteria find it very difficult to become resistant to.
And this is pretty wild, right? Like, how often do we find these kinds of antibiotics that both seem to kill everything and also seem super difficult to gain resistance to?
Yeah, there was a paper, wow, I'm blanking on the year now, but I want to say maybe 2014, 2015, this molecule Tycobactin. This molecule targets gram-positive bacteria, and the authors were also not able to get resistance to it. So SCH is not unique in that bacteria can't get resistance to it, but I think what makes SCH so powerful is that it's also a broad spectrum. It can kill gram-positives, but it can also kill the really dangerous subset of bacteria, gram-negatives.
But even still, that's just one example in, you know, a decade probably, right? So I would say this is a pretty rare thing.
Fairly unique.
I think what made this paper so spectacular is that your drug doesn't create resistance, right? And usually you discover how a drug works by finding bacteria that does gain a resistance mutation and comparing the two. Mm-hmm. But you couldn't do this, so you had to do something only possible because of the age we are in. Can you tell us about how you merged both microscopy and machine learning to perform what I am quoting you here, bacterial autopsies?
I came up with that during a lab meeting. Actually, no, I shared it with my lab at a lab meeting. I came up with it during it was a TA workshop. You know, they were trying to teach us to be better teachers. And so I was trying to explain to this room full of TAs from, you know, departments like ecology and evolutionary biology and geology, you know, how does this microscopy experiment work? And I came up with bacterial autopsies. And the reason I call them bacterial autopsies is because just like in your favorite crime show, NCIS or CSI, you do an autopsy to learn something about how the person was killed. You can look at how the bullet entered the wound, what the exit wound looked like, how cold the body is to see how long it's been there. You basically can derive all this information from the parameters, right? The features of the dead body. In the same way, we can look at a dead bacterial, quote unquote, body, cell in this case, and we can look at how the DNA changes its shape inside of the cell. Is the membrane still intact or is it now permeabilized? Are there holes in it? What is the shape of the bacteria? Is it elongated or is it even shorter? And we came up with this plan, Benjamin Bratton and Max Wilson did, where we can extract 14 different features using fluorescence markers in the bacterial cells. And using these markers, we were able to classify how the antibiotic killed the bacteria, what's known as the mechanism of action or MOA. And what we found is that in other people, the Pagliano lab specifically, what they were able to do is you can see that you can cluster antibiotics with similar mechanisms of action based on how they kill the bacteria and how you see them under the microscope. And so doing this, we basically clustered together the major classes of antibiotics that was used in the clinic, and then we added cells treated with SCH into the mix. And surprisingly for us, SCH did not cluster with any of the other known antibiotics with known mechanisms of action, suggesting that its MOA actually might be something new.
So because that wasn't high tech enough already, you then looked to high throughput proteomics to find a possible mechanism of action. At a high level, can you tell us how that works and what protein it pointed you to?
The concept behind thermal proteome profiling is that proteins that are heated up to some critical temperature will unfold, and if they're inside of a solution, they will crash, right? Originally, the protein, let's say, was soluble, so it's floating around in the water having a great time. You heat it up enough, it will crash out of the solution. And if you have a molecule, let's say a general small molecule that binds to that protein, it can shift the temperature at which that protein will crash out of solution. And so using this principle, we work with a collaborator to take the whole soluble E. coli proteome, all the proteins in E. coli that are soluble in solution, and we heated them up to a set of different temperatures. And in one set, we added no drug, and in a second set, we added the drug. And we look for proteins that shifted that point in which they're thermally stable inside of the solution. And what we found is that really only one major protein was more stable in the presence of SCH than any of the other proteins in the genome. And that protein was dihydrofolate reductase, also known as FolA.
And to really put the nail in the high-tech coffin, you then used CRISPR to confirm the proteomic results. How do you deploy CRISPR here, and what was it targeting?
Yeah, and so thanks to the Gross Lab, wonderful collaborators, they sent us a library of Bacillus subtilis bacteria, where in these bacteria, almost every gene, about 30-something thousand genes, were depleted threefold using CRISPR-I. And what was really cool is that if you then take this whole library and treat them with SCH, you see that the folate genes, right? Genes related to the ability to make folate. Those genes, when they're depleted threefold, the cells are actually sensitized to SCH. And the way I like to think about this, because it's not necessarily the easiest concept to wrap your head around, is if you're playing tag, sharks and minnows with your friends, you know, it can be an imbalance of power, right? There's only one shark, but there's 10 minnows, and so the shark is having a hard time. If that shark is SCH, it's the same way. You know, there's 10 different dihydrofolate reductase proteins. The shark SCH can only take out one of them. The cell will survive. It has 9 functional proteins. However, if you use CRISPR-I to remove, let's say in this case, half of the genes that you normally had, that one molecule of SCH will actually be way more effective than it normally would be. And doing this, we were able to confirm that folate is probably the thing that SCH is targeting.
So all this information led you to follow up with some pretty hardcore and gold standard biochemical assays. And in the end, you had a pretty good idea of what the drug was doing. What ended up being the mechanism by which the drug works, and how did this point to why it's an extremely difficult antibiotic to create resistance to?
I feel like that's a secretly a trick question that you're setting me up. Because in our biochemical assays, we were able to confirm that treating dihydrofolate reductase from bacteria with SCH disrupted its function. And that was really cool. That was powerful. We were really excited. However, that doesn't make SCH unique. There are other antibiotics that are able to target dihydrofolate reductase. And even more than that, those same antibiotics are actually incredibly easy to get resistance to. We actually did an experiment using that compound as a control, not knowing that our compound targeted the same protein. And so we were a little mystified as to why our compound seemed to have the same mechanism as this trimethoprim antifolate, but didn't have the same phenotype and resistance.
So you then kind of zoom into the, I guess it would be picometer scale here. Maybe angstrom scale is a better way of saying this. What specifically about the structure of the molecule imparts this dual mechanism that you found?
If you look at the molecule, there are several moieties present, but there are two major ones that we want to highlight. So one is this pteridine ring, basically two benzene rings stuck together. And we found that that part of the molecule is responsible for its folate. However, something that we found that was really cool is that there's this tail, there's this isopropyl benzene ring that's attached to the other side that we didn't know why it was there and what it did, but we actually found and discovered that it actually disrupts the bacteria's plasma membrane.
So you three in this paper have an awesome opportunity to write up everything that did work. Can you tell us about something that didn't work, a failure during the process that helped you build towards the final outcome?
That's a really good question. Not because there aren't failures, but because there are so many. It was the day that I had spent a whole summer and a half trying to get the biochemistry to work. We originally didn't think dihydrofolate reductase, Fol-A, was the target because, as I told you before, there were other antibiotics that targeted that, and we had already seen evidence that our mechanism of action was novel. I spent a whole summer looking at this other protein, and the data just wasn't panning out. And so we, lo and behold, get the data that Fol-A, dihydrofolate reductase, was important, and it was a dark day because we had gotten really excited about this compound. But, you know, I can laugh at it now because I know the end of the story. But at the time, it was the question of, was my committee right? Because when I took my qualifying exams, my committee asked me, do you really want to pursue the mechanism of action of this compound? You know, the odds of you figuring it out are so low. You can spend a lifetime here doing your PhD just trying to identify this. And I decided to go forward with it. And then here I am sitting in lab and I just rediscovered trimethoprim in a different molecule. But thankfully, that wasn't the end of the story. We looked at the bacterial cytological profiling, these bacterial autopsies a little closer. And that's how we were able to get a hint as to the membrane activity of SCH.
I love the optimism and the ambition there. And I love that you trusted your intuition, even when your committee of much more experienced folks were telling you that it might not be a good idea. Love that.
Truly inspiring right now.
Yeah. So you three ended your publication by further modifying the drug to increase its potency and to show it could work in a mouse model of infection. What needs to get done before we see this tested in humans? And what stage is the drug in now?
The reason why Irresistin 16, the derivative of SCH, was so effective is we made the tail, that isopropyl phenol group, we made it way more greasy, way more hydrophobic, which made it a better antibiotic. Our therapeutic window blew up, and that's how we were able to see this in vivo efficacy. But because it's so greasy, it actually is very hard to formulate and put inside of a mouse. And so one of the things that we need to do before this comes into the clinic is make a better compound, one that's more easily, you know, tolerated inside of the mouse, but still maintains its antibiotic potential. And currently, that's what we're doing. We're looking at, you know, different chemical groups and trying to make derivatives that can do just that.
How do you imagine this drug moving out of academia and into the world? For example, do you see this molecule getting sold to a larger drug company by the university's tech transfer office, or is there a company to be built around this?
I want to propose another option before I answer the question, which is the importance, I believe, of basic science. I think even if this molecule never made it into a drug company, right, what we've done is propose not only a novel pipeline, but a novel way to look at drug discovery, right? Instead of just using one assay to identify the mechanism of action, use multiple, right? Instead of just looking for a molecule with one moiety that targets your protein of interest, put two on there, right? These are ideas that had never really before been explored. But what I hope scientists do with my paper is get excited and do what academics are supposed to do, is challenge themselves and try new things and surprise not only me, but the rest of the world with what they discover.
Okay, so you're getting me excited when you talk about the novel pipeline. So let's focus on that, right? How do you envision that novel pipeline leading to improved patient outcomes? Do you imagine that that novel pipeline will just be used in the hands of other academics? Do you think that that novel pipeline might have some sort of commercial value as well?
So to be clear, the reason our pipeline is novel isn't because the individual components we created, but it's because we put them all together to solve the mystery of SCH. And I think that because of that, you know, almost open access nature of the pipeline, I would hope that both academics and pharmaceutical companies would use it to expound their idea of drug discovery from just finding something that kills bacteria, right? The first step. And then go beyond that and look for things that maybe kill bacteria in a morphologically different way. And then not only just look at protein, look at metabolism, look at how the membrane is affected. Basically expand our reasonable search for new novel molecules.
This drug is extremely promising, and I'm hopeful it will save lives as more bacteria pop up that are resistant to what we have now.
Mm-hmm.
And while we have seen academic labs like yours working towards creating these new antibiotics, we've seen far less coming out of pharma. Why is that?
The reason is, sadly, because there's a low return on investment. Putting R&D money towards antibiotic development was big decades ago. However, the money that you get back isn't that great. And there's a couple of reasons why. One of them is that you don't find anything truly unique. You end up just finding new derivatives of the same antibiotics that we have. And even though they're effective for a while, the bacteria have seen that mechanism before. And so resistance is inevitable. And the other reason is once you treat a bacterial infection, you cure it, hopefully, right? It's not a recurring thing. And so as a result, you know, your antibiotic that you use, it cures the next, you know, outbreak. And then 10 years down the line, people have made generic versions of it. And that patient population is now so small that it's not economically relevant anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's one of the reasons why pharmaceutical companies have kind of moved out of the risky antibiotic business and tried to find things that have more short-term gain.
Mm. you know, the drug itself is super powerful, but what really excited us about the paper is that you found this end-to-end pipeline to find, characterize, and then test these new antibiotics. Mm-hmm. And seeing as how the majority of our antibiotics were discovered in the early 1900s, when we didn't have access to machine learning, to multi-omics measurements, mm-hmm. or to CRISPR, it seems like it should be easier than ever before to find next-generation antibiotics. So what more needs to happen to get pipelines like yours pumping out novel antibiotics to combat this incredibly big problem of antibiotic-resistant infections?
You need a really good team. That's what I'll say. I would have never been able to do this on my own. And of course, like, you know, 100 years ago, a lot of scientists were, right? But because of globalization, I could reach out to collaborators across the sea, right? I couldn't have done this project without the biochemical and computational expertise of Ben Bratton, right? We were then able to decode the large data sets that we get from some of these large screens. Without Joseph Sheehan, who had such a great understanding of mammalian cell culture and toxicity, we would have never been able to assess the therapeutic window of SEH and its derivatives. And I think what people need to do in order to use a pipeline like this is realize if you're going to use a diverse set of tools, you need a diverse set of engineers to use them. And I think that's what most people are going to have to do in order to really make this effective.
I certainly hope that what you've demonstrated here inspires more great folks to come together to build innovative solutions like this, because yours is definitely inspiring and I think could be incredibly impactful. So James, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that episode of Translation. If you're an author of an upcoming paper in bio or know of any interesting papers dropping soon and want to hear from the authors, send us an email to translation@50.vc. We'd love to hear from you. Until next time, good bio.